Good morning. Welcome to West Hills Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. I am the Reverend Tracy Springberry, and it is my great pleasure to serve this generous, committed, welcoming, loving congregation. You are welcome on this beautiful spring day. We are in the up and downs of spring, when one minute it is raining, and the next minute we have the delights of sunshine, and the next moment the winds are blowing. I want you to know that you are welcome here, no matter who you love, no matter what your commitment, no matter whether you're vaccinated or trying your very hardest or waiting. No matter whether you have made summer plans or you don't quite believe in that, whether you've hit the COVID wall or you're just getting along fine, you are welcome in this beloved congregation. Welcome this morning to spring. So good morning again. And I just want to invite you all to coffee hour, which is after this service at 11:30. And it came in your orders of service this morning. There's a link that you can click on to join us. And that's a time that we do joys and sorrows, and we talk about the service, and we can sometimes go into breakout rooms and check in more deeply with see how each other are doing. And I also want to invite you, next week will be 1 week from when we first started going to virtual services. And we're going to be having a service about what we learned in the last year. And we're inviting you all to contribute. We're asking for less than 90-second clips with video clips, which you can just record on your in Zoom. You can hit the record button. And if you could send those to Rick Tangeman or Joe Boyd or Jane Transier, and we're going to put those all together so we can be talking about what we've all learned or how we've grown or things that have changed in our lives in the last year. We would really love to hear from you. So if you could contribute those by Wednesday, we would love to hear all the voices of WOOF and all the ways that we've transformed in the last year. So now we will light our chalice. Our chalice lighting is from Cynthia Landrum. As we kindle this flame, may it spark in each of us connection and commitment to this living tradition and to each other. We will now say our affirmation. Let us open our eyes to see what is beautiful. Let us open our minds to learn what is true. Let us open our hearts to love one another. It is time for our meditation and prayer. Dear Spirit of love and life, commit our hearts to gratitude. Let us look into our bodies and feel the beat of life. A mysterious gift given to us, and feel our breath and how it connects us to all life and Mother Earth. And let us feel grateful for that. Let us be grateful for the food we are given today, remembering that it is a direct gift from the fertile earth and the beaming sun and the running waters, and the brilliance of human cultures. Let us be thankful for the wonders of life and returning spring, the trees, the budding and new tender leaves, crocuses, and the opening daffodils. Commit our hearts to love for those whose life is opening after so long in this pandemic, who will be receiving needed relief in the recent pandemic bill, for those who are receiving vaccines and seeing loved ones, for children who will get to return to school. Commit our hearts to kindness for those whose lives will not be returning to any kind of normalcy ever or soon. Those who have lost loved ones and businesses and jobs and homes. Who watch the joyfully vaccinated, knowing it will be months until they will be vaccinated. Commit us always to gratitude, to love, and to kindness. Amen.
My name is Brad Hewitt. My pronouns are he and him, and it's my privilege and joy to be your lay leader this morning. I'd like to share with you a reading. There's a quote attributed to Ralph Waldo Emerson. A person will worship something. Have no doubt about that. We may think our tribute is paid in secret in the dark recesses of our hearts, but it will out. That which dominates our imaginations and our thoughts will determine our lives and character. Therefore, it behooves us to be careful what we worship, for what we are worshiping, we are becoming.
For all that is our life, we sing our thanks and praise, for all life is a gift which we are called to use to build the common good and make our own days glad. For needs which others serve, services we give, for work and its rewards, for hours of rest and love, we come with praise and thanks. For all that is our life, for sorrow we must bear, for failures, pain, and loss, for each new thing we learn, for fearful hours that pass, we come with praise and thanks. For all that is our life, for all that is our life, we sing our thanks and praise, for all life is a gift which we are called to use to build the common good and make our own days glad.
In 1941, James Luther Adams delivered a talk titled The Changing Reputation of Human Nature before a gathering of Unitarian ministers. Afterwards, he revised it somewhat, and 60 years later, when I attended seminary in the early aughts, I read it for 5 different classes. It changed my life, my ideas about ministry, and most importantly, about commitment, which is our theme this month. JLA, as he was affectionately called by students and friends, was from the inland Northwest, as I am. He was born in 1901 in Ritzville, Washington, the child of a conservative Baptist minister who preached the second coming every night at dinner. Later, JLA completed high school in Spokane, and then he went to Minnesota for college, where John Dietrich, the greatest humanist preacher of his age, converted him to humanism and Unitarianism. Adams later went to seminary at Harvard and became a Unitarian minister. JLA is one of the greatest theologians and ethicists of our traditions. And he came up with the five smooth stones, which you heard or heard some of or read a little bit of in this morning's Time for All Ages, which is foundational to our understanding. Lucky enough to study under him, describe understanding the world in one way when they entered his classes. And then JLA would explain something or tell a story. He was known to be a fabulous storyteller. And suddenly, their whole perception would transform. One of the great questions of JLA's life was how people transform so they will act for justice in a fair world. And his question was not academic. He had an extended visit to Germany in the late 1930s. He wanted to know how religious thinkers and churches were combating the rise of fascism. What he discovered shocked him deeply. Ministers, scholars, and church communities who had historically foundational to the liberal church as their foundation were doing little to nothing to resist Nazism. On his second trip to Germany, he visited with the few who lived in secrecy and were fighting back. And he ended up being questioned by the Nazis and was almost imprisoned, teaching him just how dangerous Nazi Germany was for those who dared to speak out. And it also led him to a deep reckoning with his soul. Fascism should rise in the States, Adams asked himself. What in your past performance would constitute a pattern or framework for resistance? I could only give a feeble answer to the question, he wrote. My principal political activities had been reading of newspapers and voting. I had preached sermons on the Depression or in the defense of strikers. But he realized that had been about it. So JLA went to work to find an adequate conception of citizen participation. Privately, he became more politically active, establishing grassroots political organizations that worked for justice, particularly against racism and McCarthyism. Professionally, he attempted to understand what was required to sustain an open and free society and what was necessary for individuals to make a commitment to the work of justice and freedom. The question of commitment was essential to him. For around him, he saw many people who had been as he was, interested, informed, concerned, active voters, but not committed in a way that could take on something as terrifying as Nazism. JLA unveiled part of his answer in the changing reputation of human nature. He argued that over the centuries, people had debated how people behave. Some argued that intellectual understanding determined people's behavior, and others argued that the will determines people's behavior. Liberals generally, he said, including his 1941 Unitarian audience, believed people were rational and reason guided their behavior. Unitarian Universalists tend to believe this today. Not everyone, but many. We believe if we just educate ourselves and others about the issues, if we just know and we just share the facts and information and reason with people, this will change behavior. JLA disagreed. He did not believe people made decisions based on reason. He believed decisions are an act of will. For JLA, the will was an active creative force that intertwined our emotions and our foundational commitments. For will to function, you needed both emotion and commitment. But the starting place was emotion, not reason. Only strong feelings have the power to change behavior, he argued. Only he called that raised affections. JLA died in 1994. But in the last decades, psychologists and neuroscience have agreed with Adams that it is feelings, not reason, that determines human action. People respond to feelings because these signals are the one of the earliest ways animals received internal information about the environment. The cognitive layer of human brains added complexity to how we process and respond to external stimulus, but it is still feelings that get our attention and hold it. Once a person has noticed something because of a feeling, they must make a decision about the situation and act. This is true about COVID. We wear masks, we socially distance, and get vaccines because we are afraid of COVID-19. It's an emotion that gets our attention. Which decision a person will make once a feeling brings it to their attention is based on their commitments. JLA said, the decisive quality of a personality is its commitment, for the basic commitment discerns the self and its interests instead of being determined by them. Commitments determine how we live our lives. When we commit in marriage to death do us part, we have a different relationship then. Let's see how it goes. When we commit to raise a child, our life is different than before we had a child. Every life is organized around commitments, whether we are aware of these commitments or not. They are those things to which we have given our hearts, our time, our energy, our money, our patience, and our love. They determine what decisions we make because they create the daily fabric of our lives. Ralph Waldo Emerson is credited with saying, a person will worship something. Have no doubt about that. And by worship, he meant these ultimate commitments, the things to which we give our devotion. He defined it as that which dominates our imaginations and our thoughts. For most people, even in the mid-19th century, he wasn't talking about God. And it certainly isn't God in ours. What do people worship in our society? To what do people give their ultimate commitments? What do we order our lives around? Money is the most obvious. People are very committed to money in our culture. It is a fabulous thing, after all. It gives you security and comfort and food and housing and transportation and fun. People are also very committed to stuff in our culture. Big houses full of stuff and storage facilities full of stuff. As a society, we have dedicated millions of acres to buildings that produce and sell stuff. Our commitment is large. We are committed to youth and looking young. We are committed to thin, being thin and very fit. We are committed to family, usually, and often to our friends and to our communities, like Woof. But we can make commitments to all sorts of things, and we do have commitments to all sorts of things. Our careers, to being right. Some people are committed to the numbing comfort of alcohol or weed or sugar. There are commitments to doing things perfectly every time, to bank accounts that grow steadily, to children's achievements, to being smart. Some people are committed to their fears and spend a great deal of time worrying about and creating barriers to their fears. Some people are committed to their well-being at all costs. The list goes on and on. And we make decisions about our lives, this decision instead of that decision, based on our commitments. And during COVID, we can see the various decisions people are making based on ultimate commitments. Some people are making decisions based on their concerns about their health and the health of other people, safety around physical health concerns. And other people are making decisions based on a stronger commitment to independence and being able to make individual decisions without government or experts telling them what to do with their bodies. Emerson said, "It behooves us to be careful what we worship. For what we are worshiping, we are becoming." A century and a half later, the author David Foster Wallace wrote, "If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, you will never have enough, never feel you have enough. Worship your body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. Worship power, and you will end up feeling weak and afraid. And you will need ever more power over others to numb your own fear. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, and you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. But the insidious thing about these forms of worship is not that they are evil or sinful. It's that they're unconscious. They are default settings." End of quote. Our commitments are often given to us without our noticing by our families and our culture and as defenses to things that have happened to us. This is what is important, we are told. This is what you must give your attention to survive. This is what matters. This is what will give you the good life. Until we do some sleuthing, we might not even know what our true ultimate commitments are. But if we pay attention, we can figure it out if we want to. What is it we really pay attention to? How do we spend most of our time? What do we worry about? What do we make plans for? Spend our money on? When we have to make a decision, where do we usually land? What usually wins? What commitment? And what usually loses? The Abrahamic faiths tell their followers not to worship idols. Many take this to mean the wooden representations of earlier gods. But theologians also say this means not to worship anything that is not worthy of our ultimate commitment, our ultimate allegiance, something beyond and greater than we are. For a while in my early 20s, my ultimate commitment was to my schedule. While raised non-religious, I had a nearly Calvinist fervor for the schedule. Part of this was because I wanted to be a writer with a capital W. And my understanding was that writers with capital W's had schedules. Well, this is true. I mistook commitment to schedule, the idol, for what was the worthy commitment, which was the creative process. When I had 3 children under the age of 5, following the schedule became ludicrous and caused something pretty much like a nervous breakdown. So then I transformed my ultimate commitment to perfect motherhood, another idol. Again, I missed the worthy commitment, which would have been to love of all kinds, instead of confusing and anxiety producing ideas about what perfect mothers do, which I'm telling you there are dozens, hundreds of books and people and blogs which will tell you exactly what perfect mothers do. Commitments that are worthy of our ultimate commitment open us up and keep opening us up to our deepest selves and to everything else, including the care and well-being of everything, of other people and the earth. It opens us to love, including JLA's commitment to justice. If our commitments close us down and shut us in and pull us away, making us indifferent and unconcerned for others' suffering and make us afraid, they do not serve us. They do not serve the world. Worthy ultimate commitments might be love, or justice, or God, or creativity, or kindness, or the earth. But our commitments to idols, to money, or stuff, or thinness, or being smart, or right, or afraid, the ones that don't serve us, those unconscious ones, really hard to give up. And sometimes it's even hard to embrace the idea that giving them up even benefits us at all. Like giving up that strong commitment to money or being thin? Isn't that supposed to make us healthy after all? So how is it we transform? JLA believed that was the work of congregations. Not just UU congregations, but any worshiping community that released the power capable of transforming people. He wrote, "Love and justice can prevail only where they are supported by the fellowship, the friendliness, the concern of each for all and of all for each, found in the community of primary relations." For JLA, the transformative power acted in the world through perceptive and thoughtful relations within a community. It was simply the act of being with others while remembering our highest aspirations that allowed us to make new commitments. Again, years later, neuroscientists and psychologists showed us this was true. In loving community, our brains are more open to creating new neural pathways, known as neuroplasticity. In community, we directly change each other's brains by creating new neural pathways through mirroring each other's actions, through arousing feeling that demands response, and by telling stories, which allows people to build new coherent neural connections. So why, all those years ago, did JLA's essay, "The Changing Reputation of Human Nature," impact me so strongly? At that time, I went to church because I loved being in community. The people, both literally and figuratively, saved my life. I loved the conversation and the idea and the music and the support of people just to live my life with. And then when I preached for the first time, I loved the way it started interesting conversations about what mattered. And I wanted to be part of doing that, so I went to seminary. But what JLA said was that wasn't enough. He said our tradition, with its belief that intellectual understanding changes behavior, had no meaningful conception of how to change people's ultimate commitments or decisions for a way of life that distinguishes, and he used old language, him and his whole orientation from the man who has not made such a decision. By which he meant, we were not a faith that would transform people to make the kinds of commitments that would stop fascism. And he was quite damning about it. He said at the end of the paper, in the last paragraph, "This element of commitment, of change of heart, of decision, has been neglected by religious liberalism, and that is the prime source of its enfeeblement. We liberals are largely an uncommitted and therefore a self-frustrating people." All those years ago, I had never thought about this. Was the goal of my faith to transform me and change my commitments to worthy ones? To raise my affections and affect my will so when I made decisions, I chose good for myself and for others? I hoped so. I fervently hoped so. Because I knew this was hard. and it was what I wanted for myself. As a person so prone to commit to idols, I wanted a faith that helped me commit and stay committed to love and creativity, and not to those commitments that I confused with love and creativity. We are Unitarian Universalists, though, and it is always an open question. What is our faith committed to? We argue it endlessly. Does being a Unitarian Universalist mean we are always on a journey toward making worthy commitments? What about JLA's question of justice and our commitment to it? What kind of commitment is really required to stop racism, fascism, and other evils? It's been 80 years since JLA wrote his essay, and still his question matters. How does a congregation help each other make and sustain worthy commitments to ourselves, to each other, and to the vast, amazing world on which we utterly depend? As we ponder, let us give ourselves to love.
Kind friends all gathered round, something I would say. What brings us together here has blessed us all today. Love has made a circle that holds us all inside, where strangers are as family and loneliness can't hide. You must give yourself to love. Love is what you're after. Open up your hearts to the tears and laughter, and give yourself to love. Give yourself to love. I've walked these mountains in the rain. I've learned to love the wind. I've been up before the sunrise to watch the day begin. I always knew I'd find you, though I never did know how. But like sunshine on a cloudy day, you stand before me now. So give yourself to love. Love is what you're after. Open up your hearts to the tears and laughter, and give yourself to love. Give yourself to love. Fire is planted like a seed. Love can't give you everything, but it gives you what you need. And love comes when you are ready. Love comes when you're afraid. It will be your greatest teacher, the best friend you have made. So give yourself to love. If love is what you're after, open up your hearts to the tears and laughter, and give yourself to love. Give yourself to love. Give yourself to love. If love is what you're after, open up your hearts to laughter and give yourself to love. Give yourself to love.
Let us go forth remembering our commitments to love, to kindness, to wonder, to the holy, to creativity, to justice. Let us go forth and live our commitments, making our lives bright, healing spark. But not the warmth and inspiration of our faith, nor our commitment to its principles. These we will carry with us until we meet again.